Tech Talk on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello, hello, hello. A very warm welcome in to Tech Talk from RNIB Connect Radio. First heard right here every Tuesday at 1 p.m. UK. You can hear us again on a Thursday evening at 9 p.m. And of course, we are available as a podcast every Friday. Tech Talk, the blind and partially sighted community's opportunity to come together and share what we've learned about the world of technology. Coming up this week, we'll be hearing why travel booking website Skyscanner are making it a priority to hire from the blind and partially sighted community. We'll also be meeting Aidan Foreman and finding out what it takes to be the Director of Technology at RNIB. And Hussein Patwa, travel consultant, will be along to tell us all about the Samsung Galaxy Watch. So that's all coming up this time on Tech Talk. Joining me this week, our co-host, Callum Stoneman. Hello, Callum. Welcome in.
Thank you. How's it going?
I'm good. Yeah, I'm really well. Just about recovered, I think, from the London Marathon and all of that.
Yes.
How about you? What are you up to? You managed to get out at the moment?
I've been doing a few little things here and there, but certainly not the London Marathon. Fair play to you. What was your time again for that?
It was a very good time. And I actually recorded the run on my watch, my pace and my heart rate and all of that kind of, all those sort of health metrics on my Apple Watch. But I am interested to know what's out there. So really looking forward to hearing Hussein Patwa later on. How about you, Callum? Do you use a sort of a smartwatch or anything like that?
Yeah, I've got an Apple Watch, but I'm really looking forward to hearing about the Samsung Galaxy Watch, because this isn't me being a typical, Apple fanboy, but the Apple Watch, certainly if you're totally blind, is really the only accessible option out there. I mean, you can sort of get info from the Fitbits. I think you can buy the Fitbit, and the Fitbit app is accessible, so you can sync it and get some of the info on there. Once it's synced across from your Fitbit device over to the app, you can read some of the data in there. But as far as I know, none of them have a screen reader. But this is interesting with the Samsung watches and these watches that are running Android now, so they should have TalkBack. It'd be really good to see what that's about, because I feel like there's not much choice out there at the minute for smartwatches.
Yeah. I mean, as a runner, I'd really like a Garmin,
yeah,
but I just haven't found one that I can use.
Yeah, well, that's the point, as far as I know. I think I could be wrong. I think there are some options for maybe increasing the text size and stuff, but there's certainly not screen readers. There's certainly not a voiceover equivalent.
Well, let us know. Do you use any wearable tech? Maybe you've got a smartwatch. Maybe you've tried something that we haven't spotted. Do get in touch. It's the usual email address. Record your voice or just send us a good old-fashioned email. And you can send that to techtalk@rnib.org.uk. That's techtalk at rnib.org.uk. Thanks very much, Callum. Stick around. It's Tech Talk. Access to travel is a regular theme here on Tech Talk. We're always interested in technology that can help us with all aspects of travel, whether that's research, booking, or assistance while traveling. Well, we are delighted to be joined by the accessibility lead from Skyscanner. Heather, welcome to Tech Talk. Good to have you with us.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
So who is the audience for Skyscanner?
Well, we're an online global travel brand, so that means our travellers are from all over the world, really. We translate our website and app into 35 different languages, so you can imagine how many people can use us. And we have over 100 million travellers using us every month, so quite a few. Yeah, so it's really from everywhere, anywhere.
And I've used Skyscanner, the app on my phone, to compare the cost of flights to international destinations. Is it possible to do that domestically as well for people travelling within the UK?
Yes, absolutely. Yep, domestic and international travel. And hotels and cars to hire as well. Those are there too.
And compared with similar services, what would you say is your USP, your unique selling point?
Probably that we really try to make the whole planning side of travelling just so much easier by offering lots of options in the one place. So you'd go onto Skyscanner, search for the trip you want to do, and then we would show you a list of providers who you could then go and book through. So that'd be like, if it was flights, it would be airlines or online travel agents. We'd show you a list and you would choose who you wanted, and then we would transfer you over to them.
Now, generally speaking, I have found Skyscanner to be pretty accessible as an app. But as a user, what happens once I've found my flight on Skyscanner and maybe I want to go ahead and book that? Can I be confident that the entire booking process, that that will also be accessible?
That is a very good question. So as I'm sure you will know, the travel industry is kind of lagging behind when it comes to accessibility, unfortunately, and that is in the physical space and the digital space. So no, not all travel providers are thinking about the digital side of things. And if it's not thought about during the design and the build of our websites and apps, then we're pretty, you know, it's pretty unlikely that you're going to get an accessible experience out the end. So that whole process is particularly difficult, actually, to get it right for screen reader users. To me, it is the hardest part. But yeah, I'm sure a lot of your listeners will know that there's a lot of travel sites out there that are obviously not even starting to think about it. So much more to be done.
Now, obviously, you are the accessibility lead, so you will be very aware of the needs of, you know, diverse range of customers. How aware is the company as a whole of the needs of customers when it comes to the accessibility of your app and website, particularly thinking about blind and partially sighted customers?
Yeah, so I would say now we are super aware, which I'm really, really pleased to say. I joined the company just over four years ago. I actually joined as a UX writer, so I was part of the design team. And back then, it was quite obvious that it wasn't a focus for the company, and that's why I kind of started a wee bit of a mission to change that. But it wasn't that we were knowingly excluding people. I think that's the problem with a lot of places, that they just don't know, they're not doing it on purpose. So the first thing to do was really raise that awareness across the whole business about the benefits of thinking about disabled people, how they use our technology, and what we can do to make that whole experience better. So we've got great buy-in from leadership, which I'm so pleased to say. And over the last few years, we've been building a brilliant accessibility champions network. So we have about 70 champs who are signed up from all different areas of the business. So these are people who are building our products, but also people in our legal team, our workplace team, our designers, our researchers. It really does span the whole thing, which is great. And all of these champions are working away in their own areas to try to do that raising awareness piece, and also then trying to really build into their processes best practice to make what they do more accessible to everybody. So yeah, I'd say we're in a pretty good place, but yeah, the industry maybe not.
And thinking about that entire customer journey, how would you characterise your current sort of level of accessibility? What's the state of the union, Heather?
Well, the short answer, way better than it was, but we know we have a long way to go. The longer answer, so there's many, many elements of accessibility that affect differently disabled people. So, for example, sighted users with vision impairments, colour contrast can be hugely important. So the contrast of text against the background colour, is it legible? And it has to meet these kind of minimum standards for most people to be able to see it. That is something that was a problem for us. Our brand palette wasn't as accessible as it could be. So we have changed that over the last 6 months, I would say, so that the colour pairings that we use when we're putting text on top of a background is so much clearer and easier to see. So that's good. For our neurodiverse travellers, we're always thinking about page layouts, you know, having as much white space on the page as we can, thinking about the orientation of text, thinking about how much content we're showing at one time, just really trying to simplify it and make it all easier to consume. And then we've got people with lower dexterity who might just be using a keyboard, trying to make things better for those users. And then our screen reader users. So yes, how good are we? Well, I would say some parts of our product are great and much better than other parts. That depends on quite a few things, actually. And one thing is that quite a lot of the elements of what we do are pretty complex. And if I say date pickers to you, you will probably know exactly what I'm saying. When you have to enter a date and you're using
hot topic, yeah, hot, it's a hot topic.
We could do a whole show on that, right? It's hard. In fact, at the very beginning, when we first started out, I contacted the RNIB and I tried to get hold of some screen reader users who I could do some initial testing with and ask them some questions. Got a brilliant bunch of people and they all said, please just let us type in a date, please. And I'm like, yes, I hear you. And we still don't offer that. There's lots of reasons why not for us, but we are doing as much testing as we can with screen reader users, particularly around that very basic part of our site, which is the search controls. You know, you put in where you're going, where you're flying from, where you're flying to, and the dates that you want to travel. So the current version of it has been tested by a screen reader user. It's better than it was. It's not as perfect as it could be, but please know that we are still working on it.
And what about the workforce at Skyscanner? How diverse are they? Do you have any blind or partially sighted people working with you currently?
So diversity is hugely important to Skyscanner. In fact, I'm so proud to work there. It is genuinely the most inclusive place I can imagine working, which is amazing. We have brilliant employee resource groups that cover race, pride, women, and we have my Accessibility Champions Network that I was talking about. We do have lots of employees with disabilities or who are neurodivergent, but nobody at the moment who is blind or partially sighted to the point of using a screen reader on a daily basis. So answer to your question is no, not yet.
But you are recruiting.
Yes, we are. And I'm very excited about it.
So tell us about that.
So this has actually been ongoing for quite some time, I will say a number of years. And we were almost about to hit the go button. And then COVID hit and hiring stopped. And it just put us on such a back burner with this. It was such a shame because we were so close. So it's just taken a little bit of time to get it back up and running again. But I'm so pleased to say that we are hiring. We're looking specifically for a blind or partially sighted software engineer to be based in either our Glasgow or Edinburgh office, to be part of an engineering squad who will be working on a section of our website. And the idea is that they will, first and foremost, they will be a software engineer and work as any other software engineer would with the team. But we're hoping that this person will help us build more accessible products purely through their lived experience and purely through the fact that they're using a screen reader on a daily basis. They'll be able to help us understand best practice in terms of what screen reader users want to hear. They'll be able to help us build code that works for everybody across all different platforms. And that knowledge that they have through that lived experience, I'm really hoping will just be a natural share with their team. So they're certainly not going to be responsible for making our entire product accessible, but I'm hoping that that natural sharing of knowledge, which we all do in Skyscanner so well, that will really help everybody, you know, understand better than we currently do. So yeah, I'm very excited about it. I can't wait.
So that sounds like a very impactful role. Where are we in terms of that recruitment process? Is the advert live?
Yes, it's live. It's been live for a couple of months. We have had quite a lot of interest, actually, which is really exciting. We have a few people going through the kind of screening and interview process at the moment, but it's still open. It's still live. So if any of your listeners are keen on a role like that, then please do get in touch. You should find it if you, I don't know if you're able to share a link to it later, but just searching for visually impaired software engineer Skyscanner, and it's the first search result that comes up on Google.
Excellent. Well, we will certainly look forward to sharing that. Are you able to speak to sort of any other sort of accessibility improvements that we can look forward to in the future with Skyscanner?
Well, the accessibility programme has been going for 3 years, as I said, and we have had a great start, but there is heaps more to do. In fact, it's never really done. It's never done, is it? It's never done as technology advances, as things change, as new features get designed and built. It's never done. So I'm excited about embedding like a program more and more into what we do, into the culture of the business. So this year we are training all of our accessibility champions. We've just bought some great new training materials, so we're really increasing the knowledge of everybody. We'll hopefully be rolling that out to all of our engineers as well. We have been working hard on our, we have a component library. So our website and app are made up of smaller components that can be reused by all the different teams that are working on them. So we've been working on it for a while on making those individual components more accessible and providing more accessibility guidance to our designers and our engineers at that stage. So it's like the library. If we can get the library beautifully accessible, it will result in an overall more accessible product. So that is getting more and more accessible all the time, which is great. We've actually just launched a new version of that. I could maybe share a link to that as well. It's called Backpack, and we have some nice accessibility guidance pages in there for designers, content writers, engineers, and product owners. Something else we're doing, which will make a big improvement to our iOS app, we are changing the way it's built so that it will work much, much better with device preferences. So if you have an Apple phone and you've turned on some accessibility preferences, the new version coming up this year will work much better with things like enlarged text or reducing motion, things like that. And we're also just really hoping to test with more and more disabled people so that we can learn a lot more. And I want to introduce that much earlier in our kind of design process. Quite often we have to wait until the thing's built so that you can actually hear it through a screen reader, but I'm hoping to involve our testers more and more in that early design phase so that we can kind of get it right from the beginning, because it really does, all the people in that product development process have to be thinking about all of our users to make that work. So the designers have to be thinking, what's that journey going to be like for someone who can't see the page? And our content writers are actually writing text that obviously is going to appear visually on the page, but sometimes we write text that only a screen reader user would hear. So we call that hidden content. That has to be considered from the beginning as well, you know, for it all to be actually built properly. It's a pretty complex but fascinating side of things. I love it, and I just hope we can get to a point where we can really shout about how accessible we are for screen reader users, so that you can all travel and do what you want to do.
Absolutely, that's what it's all about. And something you said a little bit earlier, which I think is a big takeaway, is accessibility is never done. It's not something you tick off in an hour on a Tuesday lunchtime. It's a mindset, isn't it? Not a checklist. So fantastic, Heather. Well, it sounds like you're super busy, so we better let you go. If listeners want to learn more about Skyscanner's commitment to accessibility, maybe take a look at that job ad and perhaps even get involved in some of the testing, how can
LinkedIn
we do that?
LinkedIn is probably a good place to find me. I'm on there quite a lot. We have an accessibility page on our website as well, if you want to go and look at that, on skyscanner.net, and you'll find the job ad. We talked about that already. We can share the link, or you can search for it. But yes, if anyone is keen to do some testing in the future, that would be great to hear from you.
Heather Hepburn, Accessibility Lead with Skyscanner. Thank you very much for joining us here on RNIB Connect Radio.
Thank you so much.
If you have a technology question, why not ask the Tech Talk team? Email now, techtalk@rnib.org.uk, or tweet at RNIB Radio, using the hashtag AskTechTalk.
Large organisations such as RNIB rely heavily on extensive technology infrastructure to keep staff, volunteers, customers and trustees connected and productive. It is the responsibility of the IT department to make sure all this technology is working smoothly and sensitive data is well protected. And when problems arise or requirements change, which they do regularly, it's the IT department's responsibility to anticipate our needs before we have them. At RNIB, the IT department are also expected to make sure that blind and partially sighted colleagues reliant on assistive technology such as screen readers and screen magnifiers have access to the information and tools that we need to do our jobs. The person tasked with directing this entire operation is RNIB's Director of IT, Aidan Foreman. And Aidan joins us now. Welcome to RNIB Connect Radio, Aidan. Fantastic that you're able to join us. I think I've probably only scratched the surface in terms of what you do. So can you just give us a sense of the scale of IT sort of at RNIB?
Absolutely, Dave, and thank you for having me on. In terms of the scale, I mean, we're talking about 1,200 users within RNIB, and by users, I mean staff members. We've also got a bunch of around 400 connected volunteers, which are people that come and volunteer for us that we kind of provide some form of IT equipment for, and that is across sort of 1,500 devices that we manage in total across the organisation. And in terms of locations, we're talking around seven different locations. So that's across London, Peterborough and Gateshead, and then all the country capitals as well, as well as the legendary facility in Glasgow where we host RNIB Connect Radio.
Right, and what are some of the specialist requirements, Aidan? Because obviously RNIB is doing some unique things there, the radio station, and obviously there's the production facility at Gateshead as well. What sort of specialist infrastructure do you have to have in place for those facilities?
Yeah, quite a bit, to be honest with you. When I first joined RNIB, that was one of the things that I was really aware of very quickly, which was the sheer volume of different things you get involved in. RNIB has adapted it some offering over the years, so some of those facilities that we've offered IT for has changed, but in particular the Gateshead Braille production facility, it's a PCI level one service provider, which is the highest level possible when it comes to the payment card industry standards, also ISO 27001 compliance required there as well. A lot of terminology, but it effectively means we are accredited each year, and we have assessors that come in to just double check that compliance. So we have to make sure it is ultra secure with the kind of data that we are bringing into that site to turn into accessible formats in Braille, audio and large print. You know, we've got the recording studios and the radio station, as you mentioned, they bring their own opportunities with them as well and slight challenges. But we have some really great people that work at all of those facilities as well to support us in that journey as well. And also one of the challenges also is around the ECLO. So, you know, we've got iClinic liaison officers in a number of NHS trusts across the country and working with our partners in the NHS to make sure that those guys have got connectivity as well. So, you know, it's a very varied job indeed.
And it's a sort of movable feast as well, isn't it? Sort of requirements change over time. Can you talk a bit about how IT requirements have changed? Increasingly, people working from home. We'll talk about some of the moves in just a second. But just thinking about those working patterns, what does that mean for you and your team?
Yeah, it's really strange, Dave, actually. So 15 years ago, when I first joined the organisation, work was very different. People came to a office and a place of work to do that activity. And very often, you know, from an IT sense, it was desktop computers and desktop devices that people used. At the end of the day, they left that device on that desk because they wasn't taking that desktop home with them like laptops that we do today. And of course, over that sort of 15-year period that I've been with RNIB, I've seen that shift from sort of maybe the more senior people in the organisation or a very small number of people having laptops and predominantly a desktop environment to becoming everybody having a laptop with the ability to be able to work in a really hybrid manner. So within RNIB, for example, we did a large chunk of work in 2018 and 2019 to move a lot of our on-premise stuff into the cloud, Office 365, etc. And it really saved our bacon when the pandemic hit. We were at a point in time where we only had to deploy around 120 laptops within a sort of 10-day window to enable the whole of the RNIB to work from home during that period. We managed to avoid the kind of stock shortages that were being publicised in the media by working really quickly and decisively, but working with partners as well to make sure that we could bring in that kit. And what where we find ourselves now is a really fully hybrid working model where people have all got a laptop with the ability to work from home, in a cafe or in the office. And the requirement really has become around making sure that we've got that solid meeting room technology to facilitate hybrid meetings so that people either at home or in the meeting get the same equitable experience, and also making sure we've got a really good tailored accessible office experience as well as that ability to support kit at home. So it has changed massively, to be fair.
I remember first coming to RNIB and getting the tour at Peterborough, you know, and going to see the helpline, and it was a sort of massive room with lots of people on the phone. And I imagine all those people are at home now, are they?
In the main, yeah. I mean, there are a number of people that still go into the Peterborough office to transact that kind of activity. But in reality, they are all able to work from home where required. And yeah, it's a massive change from where we were. Even just 4 short years ago now.
RNIB has recently relocated in Peterborough, of course. We moved from Midgate to Northminster, and in London, we've moved from Judd Street to the new Grimaldi building. Just talk about what you've had to do in IT to support those moves.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's a lot of planning and effort. And we've also done a lot of downsizing in terms of our estate as well. So previously across our London and Peterborough offices, we had a combined total of sort of 17 really quite large floor to ceiling kind of cabinets of equipment to kind of run the operations across the country. But through these moves and consolidations in London and Peterborough, we've really been able to reduce this down to sort of 4, you know, cabinets of equipment. And that's meant a lot smaller footprint for us to sort of host internally within our offices. So obviously the floor print of the new offices are a little bit smaller than previously, but what it does do is it manages the aesthetic of the building nicely and means that we can maximize the space for meeting rooms and desk space without the need to have large quantities of IT kit. We've done that by a mixture of moving some stuff into the cloud, but also using some shared data center space with other partners that we've got in place. In terms of work, we've had a lot of experience over the years of moving people around to different locations and moving office space. But those particular moves around London and Peterborough have been quite big moves and things that we've had to really plan well and really great project management behind it and great team members that have been able to help us make that happen. And also that experience for the, in our mind, the end user, but obviously the staff members of RNIB, to make sure that we're really designing the work environment that works for them, and making sure that we can support them in the move across from wherever they're located at the moment to the new building. And of course, it does mean a lot of out-of-hours work and hard work for the team. But to be fair, they always find a way to make these things happen and to deliver for the organisation.
And of course, you've had to provision Wi-Fi, more important than ever. You know, we used to plug into a docking station if we came into the office, and lots of people will be kind of familiar with that idea. But now everybody wants to be able to cart their device around with them and work from anywhere. And I imagine this is a bit more involved than just plugging in a home Wi-Fi router, where you need to cover an area with Wi-Fi to make sure that there's good Wi-Fi in every room.
Absolutely. So before the pandemic hit, actually, we signed a deal with Cisco for a whole new local area network and Wi-Fi solution. Possibly not the best timing in terms of, investing in on-premise kit, but also we actually did benefit from the sense we got some better pricing, and also we managed to get hold of some stock while it was available. We actually used the period of the pandemic while people weren't in the office to be able to deploy a lot of that technology. And in particular, that's now in place in the new offices that we've got. That we've mentioned just before, and that technology is a lot more robust, a lot smarter, and does allow that better flexibility for people. So, we're able to roll out Wi-Fi. Really small things like being able to roll out the Wi-Fi password. We've got options around being able to manage the number of connections and being able to split the load, as well as being able to really see where if we've got any poor performance. Monitor traffic, being able to prioritize traffic for certain things. So if somebody's doing a Teams call, as an example, with video, they might get a better priority than somebody who's maybe just doing a bit of email. Nobody notices the experience, but it is all quite smart behind the scenes to be able to really just make the organization as productive as possible.
And tell us a bit about your team, Aidan. Clearly, you can't do this all on your own. Who are they? Where are they? Is it all sort of geeky boys, or is it quite a broad church in IT?
So my team know that I'm not shy in taking the glory. Absolutely not. But I couldn't do it without the amazing team. Actually, we've got around 80 staff members across a number of different disciplines in IT, digital, data, information security, and projects. So quite a wide range of topics that we cover. It's a real diverse team, actually, and this is one thing I'm really proud of. Actually, we've made a real effort to shift the culture from a team that maybe when I first joined and was involved in early on that were hidden away in a cave, didn't really want to see the light of day, didn't want to be that customer facing team, to a team that's now made up of a real diverse set of characters. We've got people in Unst in the Shetland Islands, all the way down to Brighton, from Belfast across to Norwich, the real length and the breadth of the country. I'm also really proud to say, actually, a little stat, that 10% of the team are either blind or partially sighted. Again, it just makes me proud that we're able to have a real nice, diverse team that are able to really support the needs of the organisation.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because that was going to be my sort of next question, really, about what sort of roles are blind and partially sighted people in your team doing just now?
Absolutely. So, yeah, we've got a real mixture. So we've got some people on our service desk, and we found that to be really beneficial in the sense of, they're able to share their experiences with users that are calling into the service desk, but also help train their colleagues as well, which has been a real benefit. Our training team, again, there's some people working in there, as well as across our development, testing, data. It's a real mix across all of the team, and it's something that, again, I'm quite proud of. And we continue to develop, people as well. So really keen for people to go on training and being able to develop themselves to maximise their full potential, really. And we've created a bit of a talent pipeline, for want of a better phrase. It sounds quite grandioso, but in reality, I was given an opportunity to develop in my career, and I'm really keen for my team to be given the same opportunity. So we've got some real success stories where people have been able to develop themselves and work themselves up through the team into different roles. But of course, there's always much more we can do in that, and we continue to do that today.
I'm going to ask you about you, Aidan. I'm guessing that IT director for a large national charity wasn't your dream job growing up as a kid. What was your dream job, and how did you get here?
So when I was young, I really wanted to be an MI5 secret agent, almost James Bond style. But of course,
excellent.
Probably that might have been high up the list for a lot of people. I think that I did probably investigate it more than the average, because I just really liked solving problems and getting to the bottom of things. That was always something that I was really enthused with. But being honest with you, I first used a computer at 5 years old, Windows 95. Quite lucky that I got into that quite early on. My dad brought a computer into the house very early in my life, and that actually allowed me to kind of investigate and almost become the tech support for the household, for the family. But actually, that did really mean that I took an interest very early on. And although I didn't know what I wanted to get involved in, I knew that using a computer in some way, shape or form would be the direction I'd head. And as I went through kind of school, did the GCSEs and all that kind of stuff in IT, moving on to college, and did that kind of, carried on that kind of basis, and then really just went into an IT support role from there on, which gave me a really good grounding. Where 1 minute I could be building a server, the next minute I could be sat there in my shirt and tie, emptying a waste toner basket, so we could reuse it to save some money. That was a small accountancy firm, and that year that I worked there was the best grounding you could ever have. And then I was really lucky that an opportunity came up at RNIB, and that it was 15 years ago this year. And the organisation's really supported me to develop. I've worked with some fantastic line managers during my time who really aided that development. And I've obviously had that opportunity to develop through, from being a service desk / desktop type person to all the way through the team now to be the director. And it's such a privilege to work at RNIB in that regard and be developed in that way. And that's why, going back to the pipeline of talent, it's why I want to give back in the same way, really. So, it kind of allows me to go full circle and give people the opportunity that I've had over the years as well.
Gosh, you make me feel old. I was about 20 when Windows 95 came along. I grew up on the BBC Micro and then MS-DOS a bit later and all that. So obviously the way in which I used Windows is quite different to the way in which you use Windows. Can you remember the first time that you became aware of assistive technology? When was the first time that you met somebody using a screen reader, for example?
When I was in school, my last year at school, I suffered quite a nasty spinal injury, and it meant that I used a wheelchair for the last year of my school life. And over the course of sort of 12 months, I ended up having a couple of operations, and I was really lucky that I was able to be able to get out of a wheelchair and be able to walk it, learn to walk again. It was, at one point in time, it was, 50-50 whether that would be the case or not. But I think the one thing that I really want to share around that is the fact that having that year in a wheelchair at a school that had never had a pupil that had used a wheelchair, it was so enlightening. It was an awful experience, being completely frank. I needed some adaptions to be able to use the technology myself and be able to also to kind of go about school life. And when I left school, I was really adamant that I didn't want anybody else to have to experience what I did when I was at school. So upon leaving, I wrote a report for the school. It was invited by the head teacher at the time to do so. And I wrote a report on how inaccessible the school was, a list of improvements that they could make and should make, as well as gave them an insight into how that made me feel that I couldn't participate in the average school life. And that I feel like, in a way, that kind of probably gives a feeling for why I'm so passionate about it. It lit a spark inside me at that point in time, which I probably, I went a number of years without finding that spark again. But then when I joined RNIB, it really sort of brought that challenge back around to me in terms of inclusivity and challenging inequality. So, of course, then when it comes to assistive technologies now, first seeing somebody using a screen reader was absolutely phenomenal. For me, it was the reading speed. Very fast. If I'm to listen to it, I do struggle with that reading speed of that I've heard some people use, and it's just also the ability to navigate around so quickly. And I think that was the sort of the first feeling when I saw the first person using a screen reader for me. It really, really was really quite amazing, to be honest with you. And obviously now working with colleagues that are using them all the time, obviously you become more used to it and you understand a bit more how they work and the way that they navigate around. But yeah, for that first time, it really was breathtaking.
Join us next week, where we'll be hearing more from Dave's conversation with Aidan Foreman, and he'll be telling us about how AI might be used to help us at RNIB.
You're listening to RNIB Connect Radio. We often talk about wearable technology here on Tech Talk, and joining us to explore this area and the Samsung Galaxy Watch in particular is freelance technology and transport consultant Hussein Patwa from Aberdeen. Hello, Hussein. A very warm welcome into Tech Talk.
Hi, Dave. Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, you obviously travel around a lot and you like tinkering a bit with technology. Just talk us through a little bit about your history with wearable technology, if you would.
So I guess my first experience with wearables, Dave, would have been about 5 years ago with the Fitbit line of fitness trackers. Now, I should say that for folk with very limited vision who are unable to see a screen, Fitbit has never been accessible. But the workaround for that was to access the data via the Fitbit app or via the smart speaker. But in recent years, that has become increasingly less accessible, even with that workaround. And some of your listeners may well be aware of the recent feature withdrawals. And in addition, as the Fitbit watches have become more and more feature-packed, the access to those features has become more and more restrictive. So end of last year, start of this year, it got to the point where I just wasn't getting everything from it that I really wanted, and I had to look for a different solution. And I've been interested in smart watches, multifunction watches, for some time, and it just seemed like a good time. The technology was in a good place, having evolved quite a bit, particularly in terms of battery life and accessibility, and it was time for us to move on.
And what's the motivation for you, Hussein? Are you looking to count steps, or are you monitoring heart rate or something else? What drives your interest in wearables?
It's twofold for me, Dave. I have to work a lot of my fitness, especially after the pandemic. That really affected me quite badly. But also, I guess I also wanted a different option to having to constantly use my phone for everything. And the Galaxy Watch in particular is more than just a fitness device. It's pretty much a computer on your wrist, really. And it does offer that independence and that flexibility, as opposed to always doing everything from a mobile handset.
Yeah, we will get into the watch in a second. And you're right, sometimes it just means that you can review a message or respond to something quickly without having to rummage around and, you know, grab your phone or whatever. First world problems and all that. When it comes to accessing technology, do you have specific requirements? Just sort of talk us through that.
Absolutely. So as someone with retinitis pigmentosa, you know, a little bit of peripheral vision, but really very, very limited. And as someone who is unable to see a screen now, for me, having a device that has speech access or the potential to access that through Braille, for example, is really important. That is a deal breaker for me. It also needs to be fairly easy to use. And I guess partially accessibility, but partially from a technology standpoint, it needs to be customizable and flexible. I hate something which I can't tailor to my own needs, or as you said there, I love the word, something that I can't tinker with.
And am I right in saying you do make quite a lot of use of dictation as well?
Absolutely. I have a chronic pain condition, which affects both hands. It's Raynaud's disease. So for me, doing things hands-free, using my voice to control features or to, for example, write messages, a really big important thing for me as well.
So what made you choose the Samsung Galaxy Watch specifically?
I guess partly this was ideological. I've never really been a fan of the Apple ecosystem. For me, it's never been particularly tinkerable. It can be done, but I always found Android to be far more open and customizable. Samsung had a good price point for me. It was relatively affordable. And having a Galaxy phone, I was familiar with the ecosystem and I liked some of the features, especially the artificial intelligence features that the Galaxy ecosystem offers. So it made sense to stick with something I'm already familiar with. Equally very important for compatibility, it makes sense to go with something that would pair nicely to the phone as well. I also didn't want to be particularly tied to an online service such as iCloud, which is a cornerstone of the Apple system.
And did you get the chance to try before you buy? Did you get any hands-on with the watch before you took the plunge?
I never experienced a smartwatch of the ilk that the Samsung Galaxy is before. I'd read a lot about it, read a lot of reviews on forums and online, but I was fortunate enough to purchase this from a fairly large retailer that has quite a generous returns policy. So I wasn't particularly concerned about being able to return it if everything went horribly wrong.
Right, because that's often the case, isn't it? If you order something online or over the phone, there are distance selling rules that mean that if it's not suitable, then you can return it for a full refund within, usually it's 30 days, isn't it?
Yes, between 14 and 30 days. As I say, these guys are really quite generous with that. And it's something that, as somebody who can't benefit from seeing the picture of a device or be able to watch a video and actually physically see how this looks, that's really important for me as well, especially as we have fewer and fewer places on our high streets where we can just go in and ask to feel something or try it on for size.
Yeah, so check with your suppliers, obviously, to make sure what the returns policy is, but auditioning something in your own home is often the best way. So what were your first impressions then when you received the watch?
I think for me, it was just how normal it looked. I don't know what my expectations were of a smartwatch, but it kind of looks a bit retro, so I'll describe it for your listeners, Dave. It's essentially quite a big watch. It's 45 millimeters, so just less than 2 inches wide, which is looks pretty big on my wrist. It's got the strap is a silicone strap with a magnetic closure, which is great for me because I always have a bad habit of over-tightening my wristbands, and I've broken quite a few on my Fitbit devices, which have the traditional buckle and pin. So the magnetic clasp is pretty neat. The watch itself, it has a recessed scratch-resistant face with a round bezel around the top, and two fairly large tactile buttons on the right-hand side, one at the 2 o'clock position, which is the home key, and one at the 5 o'clock, which is a back key, and they can be remapped for specific apps or actions. One thing that we should say for those of your listeners that are familiar with the Galaxy watches, they have now done away with the rotating bezel on the top of the watch, which a lot of people found really helpful for accessibility. I really haven't noticed the difference, to be honest. I think they've mitigated that really well by some of the features that they've included in it.
And what was the unboxing experience like? Were you able to get it talking independently?
So that is a caveat which really disappoints me. And it's the one thing that really disappoints me about this watch. Anyone who's bought a new Android phone knows that it's pretty much set up out of the box. Usually you hold down the two keys on the right hand side and up it comes talking. They haven't implemented that into the Galaxy Watch. And the annoying thing, Dave, is that the amount of sighted assistance to get this working is literally about 10 seconds. It's as simple as selecting the language, which is one tap, and then tapping the agree button to the T's and C's. And my mum was able to help me do that after about 10 seconds. The rest of the process of setting up is fully accessible through the Galaxy Wearable app on your phone. They do tell me that this can be set up with non-Android phones, but for compatibility, I would recommend a Samsung Galaxy just to keep everything ticking over smoothly. Fortunately, you can turn the TalkBack screen reader on from the mobile phone. So in that respect, once you've got past the initial two steps for the setup, the rest of the pairing, this is a cellular model, so purchasing the phone plan and getting everything else set up, all the data transfer is fully accessible from the phone. But it's just really disappointing that very initial step is not accessible. And I had to do a bit of Googling to find out exactly what that first step was and eventually just got my mom to help me.
And obviously, just to explain, the cellular option means that you're able to use it online when you're away from your phone.
Yeah.
How have you found the learning curve?
Relatively straightforward. So for anyone who's used Android, it's the same ecosystem. It uses Wear OS. So we're on version 3 now, 3.5. Anybody who's used the TalkBack screen reader, I should say it does have other accessibility features as well. It's got high contrast and it's got visual access as well as some of the dexterity options that folk who've used, again, Android will be familiar with. But for me, TalkBack is the primary feature that I use. And the gestures for that are exactly the same as on a normal Android phone. So in terms of learning curve, very, very little. The one thing that did surprise me is, you know, when you think of a 2-inch screen, it seems extremely small. And there are a couple of times I found that my hands are just a little bit too big for the screen. But generally, when you start using it, you do learn to minimize your gestures, how widely you move your fingers on, not too badly at all. So I wouldn't let the screen size be something that puts you off trying this if that's something that you're interested in.
And how have you found the battery life?
I get between 2 to 3 days out of it, which is pretty good for a wearable. For something that's receiving notifications, taking a few calls on it, the location feature is always on. I could probably turn that off if I wanted to stretch the battery a bit more. But 2 to 3 days is really quite a good yardstick for this kind of technology. And that's something that stopped me adopting this at an earlier stage because we just weren't there in terms of battery life.
And what sorts of things are you using the Galaxy Watch for? What are some of your favourite features?
The primary ones for me were the fitness and the sleep tracking, and it's really accurate in that respect. It's even able to detect if I'm just moving my hand, for example, when I'm talking, versus if I'm actually moving. It's got a heart rate sensor on board, which is pretty good, and that's given me some useful information with other health conditions that I have. And the ability to take calls and messages on the watch, I just think that's the coolest feature ever. One thing that's interesting I've noticed is it's changed my behavior in terms of the way I use my phone. I'm spending a lot less time with that because I have a very bad habit of, as we all do, you know, we check notifications and then we end up tinkering with something else, and before we know it, the time's passed and we've gone into all sorts of things. The watch stops me from doing that. It will speak out messages, it'll speak out calendar events. I find that really handy. But other than that, I feel a lot more independent in the broadest sense of that word. It doesn't feel as if I'm as tied to the phone as I was before.
Yeah, I can relate to that. You know, I have Apple Watch, and certainly that happened to me. You tend to find you can disappear down a bit of a rabbit hole, don't you? You check a message on your phone and then suddenly you're on social media and you've lost an hour of your life. So yeah, I hear you.
There's quite a few accessibility features on here that are probably worth mentioning as well, and a few interesting use cases which your listeners might find interesting, Dave. And, you know, there's an hourly chime built into this, which sounds really simple, but anyone who's had a talking watch before, that's part and parcel of that. I discovered this, again, purely by accident, but that's one of the things I like about the operating system, is it will always suggest little tweaks and features. The other thing which is quite handy for the acoustic rifle shooting sport that I do is I can set a mode where I can tap the screen and it'll vibrate a number of times to tell me the time. And that's really handy in a sporting context, because the rules of our sport mean that we're not allowed to have external audio to interfere with other competitors. So that's been pretty helpful. And lastly, and this is an interesting one I just stumbled across by accident, the watch allows you to save walking routes, or I guess driving routes as well, and save them as what's called a GPX file, which, you know, very simply is a text file that contains a list of points along a route. And I see there's a real opportunity here. If you imagine, for example, going to an unfamiliar city, you could potentially in the future have the option to share accessible routes from other people who are wearing similar devices, load them onto your device, and that could, for example, come in really handy if you want to find your way between key points of interest in a safe way. And as I say, it was just something that occurred to me purely by chance, but the watch has that feature built in as standard, and it's something, as these devices become more ubiquitous, that we may well see actually helps people in a really unexpected but helpful way.
You already touched on the fact that you had to get some sighted assistance to get the watch talking out of the box. Have you run into any other accessibility challenges along the way?
Not accessibility per se. I think just due to the limitations of the processor, sometimes it can be a little bit buggy. You often find, you know, especially when you're waking up from sleep, you might have to wait a couple of seconds before it'll respond. The other thing is it does have an on-screen keyboard, but by its very nature, that keyboard is quite small, and I haven't quite got to grips with typing on that. So I tend to use the voice typing dictation feature, which is built in as standard.
Overall, then, it sounds like you'd recommend it.
Absolutely. For me, it's been a liberating experience. I think I'm only just scratching the surface of what it's going to allow me to do. I've taken a few calls on it, and people find that the call quality is surprisingly clear. They can't tell the difference between a regular phone and this watch. The ability to have spoken notifications and a very limited number of notifications, I find that's giving me a lot more time to do other things, and I'm not spending time just aimlessly scrolling apps, for want of a better word, as I might have done in the past. And I think because it uses the same Play Store and the same operating system features as the Android phone, in terms of customizability and what I can do with this, it's very much you know, what the limit of your imagination is for me. So I definitely recommend it. It does come in a non-cellular option, which is a little bit cheaper, but I wouldn't be without the cell option myself.
Do you remember what the pricing is?
It was $479 as cellular. And I was very lucky to have a number of gift vouchers stored up. So that was quite helpful in that regard. And I think the non-cellular option is about £80 cheaper.
And we should emphasize you don't have any affiliation to Samsung or Google.
Not at all.
Well, thank you so much, Hussein. That's been really fascinating and a beautiful description. And I hope that that's been helpful for folk. I'm sure there'll be lots of people listening who are interested to hear what else you're up to, including that acoustic shooting. We should definitely explore that at some point. And also your work in access to transport. What's the best way to stay in touch?
So you can find me on social media. It's Hussein Patwa on Facebook. I'll spell that. It's H-U-S-S-E-I-N and Patwa is P-A-T-W-A. I'm also on Twitter at Hussein_Patwa. And if you want to get in touch by email, then ping me a message by any of those two and we'll be able to connect.
Hussein Patwa, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Now, would you believe it? The current incarnation of Tech Talk, we've been with you for a whole year. Our first show was on the 3rd of May, 2022. And since then, we've done more than 50 shows. And there has been quite a lot of variety and quite a lot to look back on. Callum Stoneman, any highlights for you?
Yeah, I honestly can't believe that it's been a whole year that we've been doing this. It's incredible. I mentioned before David Woodbridge. It was a real pleasure to speak to him, especially after following his podcasts for so long. The conversations we've had with Netflix was great. The panel discussion we did as well with, you know, what our predictions for the 2023 year was. It's been a real journey, hasn't it?
It has indeed. And and which reminds me, we have spoken a lot as well about transport as well, and the role of technology there. And you heard from Skyscanner, of course, earlier on. I enjoyed speaking with What Three Words as well to help you sort of precisely locate yourself, something that I could have done with on Sunday morning the other week when somebody dropped me off in an Uber and then drove off and left me in the middle of nowhere. So, technology can dig you out of those holes, but also technology can get you into those holes as well. So we're always keen to sort of find out more and challenge and answer your questions. And if you've got a problem with technology, you know, if you're not getting any traction, if there's an issue, do let us know and we will try to investigate that for you. And we're certainly not going anywhere. We are going to be here for the foreseeable.
Well, hopefully not.
Well, that's right, yeah. So so tune in next week when we'll hopefully be back, he says, touch wood. We're going to be hearing more of that conversation, of course, with Aidan Foreman, the Director of IT at RNIB, and of course your listener emails as well. So if you'd like to be a part of it, do get in touch. Your voice notes and emails very welcome to techtalk@rnib.org.uk. It's techtalk@rnib.org.uk. But from myself and Callum Stoneman,
bye for now.
Bye-bye.